First Samuel chapter 1. Let's read verses 1 through 11 as we begin this morning and see the beginning of a story of a man named Samuel, his beginnings, his parents, and where they came from. So 1 Samuel 1, verse 1, it says, "Now there was a certain man of Ramathim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. And when the time that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary also," and this is Peninnah, "and her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? Apparently not, by the way. Verse 9, "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." I've entitled the message this morning, "A Dysfunctional Family." Anyone ever been a part of a dysfunctional family? There are no perfect families in the world. And the reason is there are no perfect people. And our profound thought for today is that families are made up of people. And if you have imperfect people, put them all together, you're going to have a mess many times. And so that's one of the things that we see in this family. We see dysfunctionality. We see strife and heartache and sorrow. We see jealousy and bitterness and enmity. Home is supposed to be a place where there's love and acceptance and joy. Instead, we find the total opposite here and in many homes. This is something that we can all at times relate to. I want to look at some of the key players in this story and their part in the family dynamic that went on in the house of this man, Elkanah. So let's start with him, Elkanah. And by the way, was Elkanah an Ephrathite, or was he a Levite? This passage does not mention, so by the way, let's read verse 1 again. It says, "Now there was a certain man of Ramathim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephrathite." And the word Ephrathite is also translated an Ephraimite. An Ephraimite, Ephrathite are the same thing. So it says here that he's from the tribe of Ephraim. He's from Mount Ephraim. But in another passage, look at 1 Chronicles, if you'd hold your finger here. 1 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 31, it mentions that he is a Levite. He is from the Levitical, and so he is involved. It doesn't mention it here in 1 Samuel, but 1 Chronicles mentions that not only Elkanah, but his family was involved in the Levitical priesthood service at the temple, and both he and his family. So let's look at his lineage here. 1 Chronicles 6 and verse 31. It says, "And these are they whom David set over the service of song in the house of the Lord after that the ark had rest. And they ministered before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem." And then they waited on their office according to their order. And these are they that waited with their children of the sons of the Kohathites. And so the Kohathites were a particular family in the tribe of Levi. Of the sons of the Kohathites, He-Man. This is not the He-Man from the cartoons. This is another He-Man. Of the sons of the Kohathites, He-Man, a singer, the son of Joel, the son of Shemuel, the son of Elkanah. This is the same Elkanah that Samuel's father that we read of in 1 Samuel 1. The son of Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eliel or Elihu, the son of Toa. And so Elkanah was a Levite according to 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Why is this important? Why is it a big deal? Okay, he's from Levi, he's from Ephraim, who cares? He's from Israel, let's go on. It is an important thing because of what God set up. God said that only the Levites, only the priests, the Levites, are able. And by the way, to be a priest, you had to be a Levite. Not all Levites were priests, but all priests had to be Levites. And so this family, God had set up that only Levites were allowed to do certain things. Only they could be involved in the worship system at the tabernacle. Now other people could go and the Levites would help them. But only the Levites could offer the certain offerings and sacrifices and be involved with, for instance, setting up and tearing down and moving the tabernacle as it's still a tent at this time during his lifetime. And it's important because Samuel, his son, does things in his ministry that are reserved for the priests. And if Elkanah is from the tribe of Ephraim and not the tribe of Levi, then Samuel would not be qualified. It really comes to a head because Saul, the king, was rejected by God from being king for doing something, and we won't turn there today, but in 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul, he says, I forced myself and I offered this sacrifice. And he was supposed to wait for Samuel to do that. And so God rejects him from being king. And why was Samuel allowed to do the other places, for Samuel chapter 9 and 7 and other places where Samuel does other things that are only reserved for the priests? So it's important to figure out. And so, by the way, do we have an error here? Is 1 Samuel wrong? Is it an error? Was he from Ephraim or was he from Levi? And, well, don't confuse him with the details. Let's just go on. We don't want to do that. Because if there is a discrepancy, it would be a problem. He was both from the tribe of Ephraim and Levi. Well, how is that possible? Typically, when someone say you had to pick one tribe, what tribe are you from? If you would name one tribe, it would be the tribe that your father is from. But there was often intermarriage between the tribes, and it was fine. The intermarriage problem came in is when they would intermarry outside of Israel and intermarry with the heathen and so forth. But they were allowed at times. They had to keep property and land in the family. So sometimes if by marriage a tribe would shift and that property would shift, then at a certain time it would have to default and go back to the original tribe. So the land, the reason the tribes were important and knowing who was from what tribe was important. Sometimes it was to know if you're qualified to be a king. Sometimes it was to know if you're qualified to be a priest. And sometimes it was for the land to make sure that the inheritance of the Lord stayed in each tribe. That was very important. So Samuel and his father Elkanah were both from the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Levi. This is not the only time you see something like this in the Bible where a Levite is also from another tribe. Look at Judges chapter 17 and verse 7. Some people have a real problem here with what's going on in this verse we're about to look at. But as we mentioned, their intermarriage was okay between the tribes. And so Judges 17 and verse 7, it says, and by the way, the things that go on in this passage were not according to God's will. But just to show that this man was from two tribes here, Judges 17:7, and there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. Some people push pause right there. Hold on. He was from Judah or he was from Levi? Which one? You couldn't be a Levite unless you were from the tribe of Levi. And if you were of the family of Judah, then you are, that's what tribe you are from. So this man, probably his father was a Levite and his mother was from the tribe, from the family of Judah. And so there was a crossover there. In fact, David himself, look at 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 12. Where was David from? He's famously from the tribe of Judah. He was one of the kings. Jesus was the son of David, also from the tribe of Judah. And yet it also says about David's father, Jesse, same word as it uses about Elkanah, that he was both an Ephrathite and he was from Judah, we already know. So 1 Samuel 17, verse 12, it says, "Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had eight sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul." And so Jesse was from the tribe of Judah, and yet he was also at some point from the tribe of Ephraim. He was an Ephrathite or an Ephraimite. And so Elkanah, hopefully we don't want to dwell too long on here, but I just said this to say that Samuel never did anything that was out of step with what he should have done because he wasn't from the right tribe. He was from the tribe of Ephraim, but he was also a Levite, and so he was qualified to do those things. All right, so let's go on and look at Elkanah's second. First of all, he's an Ephraimite and a Levite. Number two, he's a polygamist. This is what we're going to focus on. This is one of the main things we know about Elkanah. So it says that back in 1 Samuel chapter 1, it says, "And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children." 1 Samuel begins at the end of the days of the judges. We've mentioned this last week, that Samuel was a judge. He was the last of the judges. And one of the things that characterized the days of the judges was, and this is the last verse in the book of Judges, we looked at it last week, but Judges 21:25, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." And so we're introduced in the book of 1 Samuel with Elkanah, and he has two wives. The name of one is Hannah, the name of the other is Peninnah. And what are we to think about this biblically? And so we'll spend a little bit of time. We've done this in the past when we were going through the book of Genesis. We won't spend too much time, but want to mention it briefly here. Oscar Wilde famously once said that bigamy is having one too many wives. And monogamy is also the same thing, having one too many wives. That was a joke. I don't know if he's on to something there or not, but researchers say that societies where men can marry more than one woman are typically more violent societies. You say, why is that? The study found that in polygamous cultures, levels of rape, kidnap, murder, and robbery increase as the dissatisfied men left on the shelf go on the rampage. Interesting. So in a polygamous society, you know, if the population levels are 50-50, and typically there are more women than men, but in our nation it's always been like, you know, 52 to 48 or something like that. So pretty close. But if you live in a polygamous society and a lot of men have two women, then that's going to take the pool from which to find women is going to shrink dramatically. And this study determined, and I haven't traced it out to see the validity of it, but this study found that when men don't have as many options to get married and they have to stay single, that they just become enraged in general, or they go out and on this murderous kidnapping, robbery rampage. And I don't know if there's necessarily truth to that, but God set up things a certain way, and then man does things a certain way. It's under Islamic martial jurisprudence, a man can take up to four wives in Islamic culture. They're allowed to marry up to four wives as long as he treats them all equally. Oh, okay. Well, that's no big deal. Just long as that's probably impossible for a man to be married to that many wives or even two wives and treat them all equally. Whenever you see polygamy in the Bible, you always see he doesn't treat them equally. And it becomes the source of, and we see that here. It's very obvious. The first polygamist in the Bible was a man named Lamech. We won't turn there, but Genesis 4 and verse 19. He was the first man with two wives. He was also a very aggressive man. He murdered someone. He was from the line of Cain, when they trace him down. Never in the Bible is there one person that we can point to definitively and say he was a believer, he was a godly man, he was a good man from the line of Cain? Never happens one time. I'm not saying it never did happen, but it's never recorded. And Lamech was not a godly man, but he just decided out of the blue, I think I'm going to marry. And he was probably the first one in history because of how the Bible points him out for this. But it says that he took unto him two wives. So what is God's perspective on polygamy? And so we'll look at this briefly. For some of these passages, we'll just refer to them. I'll mention where they are. We won't read them. But first, let's turn to this. I want to see from the beginning. This is where we always need to start, right? We should never just take societal norms, see the way society is doing, and say, hey, you come over here. You come over here. What do we think about this? And just evaluate it based on what we think. We need to go back to God's intent and God's design. And a wonderful truth is that God is the originator of marriage. God, marriage is not, there are so many people out in the world that say, well, this was like this and then was like that. So then man came up with marriage to do this. God is the one who invented and designed the two sexes, male and female, and he created marriage before there was ever sin in the world. And so look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 23. This is where we see God speak his mind about marriage. Genesis 2 and verse 23. It says, and Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, and I'm, for sake of time, I'm going to spare you all the jokes on that this morning. But anyway, you can go look them up online. Therefore, shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife. It doesn't say cleave unto his wives. It says, and they shall be one flesh. And Jesus, when he quotes it, he says, and they twain, or they two, shall be one flesh. And the way that God has set up this formula, you can't add another person. There's no three becoming one flesh. There's no four or five, or with Solomon, 1,000 becoming one flesh. It's totally out of God's design. When God defines marriage, he sets it up, and it leaves out the possibility of polygamy in this passage. We won't turn here for sake of time. What are we to do with passages where the Bible seems to go with the flow on polygamy? And by the way, here in 1 Samuel, some people say this is one of them, that God just mentions it, but there's nothing negative said about it, other than looking at what happened, other than the consequences come about it. And this man in the Bible is polygamous, and this man, and God never specifically condemns it. And there are places where in Deuteronomy 17, God gives rules for the regulating of polygamy to make sure that the children are not improperly given the inheritance and so forth. So what are we to think about that? Is God okay with it? And does the Bible get it wrong on polygamy? As so many people gather around and cast judgment on God and the Bible for lots of different things. Well, the Bible got it wrong on polygamy. The Bible got it wrong on slavery. The Bible got it wrong on homosexuality. And now we've figured things out. So as we've just seen, this is where Jesus would take us back. If we were to ask Jesus, what does God think about polygamy? Jesus would say, from the beginning, look at Genesis 2 that we just read. This is God's intent. And a similar thought, by the way, same chapter, Deuteronomy 17, both it shows regulations on polygamy, and yet it also later in the same chapter commands that it, for kings specifically, that they are not to multiply wives, that it's forbidden there. So we see often the and by the way, also, well, for a second time, trying to decide how much of these passages to mention or to look at. It is similar to passages on divorce, where what does God think about divorce? And God regulates it. Deuteronomy 24 regulates divorce. But does that mean that God is okay with it? The Pharisees came to Jesus one day and said, God is okay with divorce. And so why did Moses give us the commandment that we can put away our wives and give her a writing of divorce? And Jesus says a very important thing. He says, because of the hardness of your hearts, God gave you this precept. But from the beginning, it was not so. In other words, God is not condoning divorce. And I'm going to bring the same principle in with polygamy. God is not condoning divorce and polygamy, but because they were sinful and they had decided, I don't care what God says, I'm going to do this anyway. Then God kind of put some damage control in place so that they wouldn't take this and run with it. And with polygamy, one of the things that could have happened that God protects is marrying someone, putting them away, second wife, and with the divorce in Deuteronomy 24, he potentially is trying to keep people away from the slave trade, where from a heathen, someone would marry someone from a heathen nation and say, oh, I don't like her, and send her away. And that person would often end up in the slave trade business. And so God set up some things to guard it. But that doesn't mean God was ever for it. Because of the hardness of their hearts, God set the parameters on divorce. And I think for the hardness of their hearts, God set parameters on the polygamy. But that never means that God was for it. And always, so anyway, there's God's commands. There's also the consequences that we see of it in families. Now, this is maybe kind of preaching to the choir. You know, in case you're considering polygamy this morning, let's talk about, you know, probably not considering it, but sometimes people are scratching their head. What do we think about it based on the Bible? So I want to look at some of the ways. Look at Genesis chapter 16 and verse 1. Some of the ways that you always have a dysfunctionality in a home and some of the consequences that come from this divided love that happened in polygamy. Abraham, you see it in the patriarchs, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, and two of those three men were married to or had children with more than one wife or concubine. So Genesis 16 and verse 1, here's the story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, so this starts with Sarah's, it's her idea. I pray thee, go in unto my maid, it may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And it probably took him a long time. It probably took him weeks and months before he eventually agreed. I doubt that. I can take her. Okay, good. You know, and he just, you know, real fast, he takes her. He goes in into her, and she gets pregnant. Look at verse 3. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. And he went in unto her, to Hagar, and she conceived. And here's where we see some of the consequences. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. In other words, Hagar gets pregnant, and then Hagar immediately hates Sarah. And there becomes all of a sudden this competition and rivalry and animosity. And look at verse 5. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. Abraham, you never should have agreed to this. Me, it's your idea. Yeah, but you should have, you know, Lord judge. And now you've got these big problems. It goes on. The children. Finally, Isaac is born from Sarah. And you've got rivalry with the children. There's a birthday party one day, and it's a celebration for Isaac. And Ishmael is over here mocking. And Sarah says, that's it. Get him out of here. And they kick him out. And and the whole family is torn apart. And it started because of bringing in polygamy. And you can't share love. You can't be one flesh with two people. It's impossible to do that. And there are so many levels. You can't understand one woman, let alone more than one. I'm just kidding. That was a joke. That was not in the Bible. The Bible says the husbands are to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. So it is possible. It does take the Holy Spirit. If you're an unbeliever married, good luck. No. You see the consequences and the problems and the infighting that happens. We saw it, we won't turn here, but Jacob, this is another famous one, and we may look at this later. Jacob married Rachel and Leah, and problems came between those two women, and then they started having children, and problems came between their children. Jacob loves one more than the other, and there's hatred, and one has children, the other doesn't, and that spawns hatred and teasing and animosity, and then their children. Jacob loves Joseph more than the other children, and they hate him, and they can't speak peaceably to him. So polygamy destroyed their family dynamic. You see David in the Bible. He married many wives. He also had committed other sins with adultery and murder, but in order, you know, polygamy was involved with that. He was already married when he took Bathsheba to be another one of his wives. And so he has many children, and those children didn't like each other. Those children raped each other and murdered each other, and he had horrible problems in his family. And it all started with bringing in other, you know, these divided loves. And as I said, just because the Bible seems to be silent on it at times does never mean that God was okay with it, that it was his will. Okay, for sake of time, let's move on. We'll come back to some of that dynamic. But as a result of some of it was connected, some of it was her own fault. But because of the polygamy, because of Elkanah's polygamy, now you have two wives, one has children, one doesn't. And the second thing I want to look at this morning is Penina, the adversary, the enemy. Look at back in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 4. It says, and when the time that was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Penina his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions, but unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. When it says that he loved Hannah, he gave her a worthy portion because he loved her. You can read in between the lines, he didn't love Penina. And he didn't love all of her children, it seems like. Or else he would have given them certain things. But he loved her at least more, and it meant perhaps the only one that he had love toward. And by the way, so Elkanah, he's a saved man. He's a somewhat godly man, we could say. It says that he goes up yearly. And by the way, he went up yearly to sacrifice to the Lord. He's a Levite. He goes to the temple one time a year. He goes to the tabernacle one time a year. How often should he have gone, according to the Bible? Three times a year. There were three feasts that all the males should have gone to. And I think that it just wasn't happening. I think most people just went once. And so he went once. And by the way, this was not an isolated thing. This is the nation of Israel often. They rarely kept the Feast of Tabernacles the way God wanted to. It was too far, and you have King Jeroboam making things easier and not doing it according to God's will. Even when you see Jesus born, Jesus' parents, Joseph and Mary, Joseph went to the temple one time per year. He should have gone three. Everyone, but the whole society is not following God the way that they should. And so Elkanah, he is a godly man, as in, he's following God, kind of. I mean, he's married to two wives. He doesn't go as often as he should. But he does go and worship God and offer sacrifices to God. And when he does it, he gives gifts. And while he's giving those gifts, he has favoritism. So he's not a perfect man, but he is a believer. We could say he's a believer that has his flaws. And so then you have Penina. And this does not excuse Penina from her actions. We'll get to her in a moment. But I believe that a lot of the adversarial things happening between Hannah and Penina, you trace back to Elkanah and his favoritism. If he had loved Penina, I don't think she would have taunted Hannah like she did. But because Hannah received the love that she didn't get from Elkanah, then she looked for any way to see that she's better. Oh, and I have the children and she doesn't, so I'm better than her. And she holds that over her. And it starts with Elkanah and his favoritism. Elkanah, the father, is the one who destroyed this family by going down this road. Jacob also did the same thing. By the way, let's get back to Jacob real fast. Look at Genesis 37, verse 3. We mentioned this, but I want you to see how it played out in Jacob's. We won't look at the verses that talk about the dynamic between Rachel and Leah, but theirs is striking because they start naming all of their children, at least Leah. She names all of their children after the rivalry with Rachel. She names her children names like, now my husband will dwell with me because I've given him this many sons. And now, finally, my husband will love me. And it's all based on the rivalry because of Jacob's polygamy. What should Jacob have done, by the way? He was deceived. May need to switch microphones here. Let me know if I need to switch. Jacob was deceived into marrying Leah first. I believe that Jacob should have just said, okay, I guess God wanted me to just marry Leah and then just stay with Leah. But instead, he, 1 week later, he adds Rachel, and then the rest of his life is miserable because of that. And so look at the way that it came out in their children. Genesis 37 and verse 3. Genesis 37:3 says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him." So it was one thing, and by the way, this is going to happen. It says that he loved him more, and then it says his sons saw that he loved him more. And if there is in a family this favoritism and division, it's going to be known. It's going to be obvious, and then it'll result in problems. And so Penina had that to deal with. It was Elkanah who started it, but then Penina also pitched in. She could have responded well, but she responds with this envy. She was both envied and envious. They both had something the other didn't have. One had the husband's love. One had children. Which one do you need to have? Do you need to have both to be satisfied in life? What happens if you're not married at all and don't have children? Can you possibly have a joyful life? You could. But neither one was enough for Rachel and Leah, and then for Penina. It wasn't enough. And so she was filled with selfishness. She held her success over Hannah's failure, and she had no graciousness to her. For sake of time, we won't turn here, but just listen to a couple of verses. Proverbs 24 and verse 17 says, "Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth." This is where Penina was. She loved it that Hannah couldn't have children. Every time she had another child, she would take it up to Hannah. "Hannah, guess what? Pregnant. What do you think of that?" You know, she would kind of, I don't know how much she would do it, how immaturely, but she would really flaunt it every time she had a victory and Hannah didn't. She didn't empathize with Hannah's struggles. She could have. She could have thought, you know what? I am destitute myself. I wish my husband loved me. And I'm beside someone who wishes they had children. She felt hurt, and she should have commiserated with Hannah's hurt. But she didn't. Here's what it says in Romans 12:15: "Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep." When we are surrounded by people that are struggling because of some unfulfilled expectation, we should never rub it in their face or rejoice. You don't have that? I do. It's an immature, selfish Christianity. And Penina should have shown love, but instead she was an enemy. So Penina the adversary. And let's spend the rest of our time talking about Hannah the barren. The Bible says a lot about fruitfulness versus barrenness. With women being able to have or not being able to, in being able to have children. In the past, there has been a stigma attached. In the Bible days, there was a stigma attached to women that either didn't or couldn't have children. They would say that God has judged you. And so people were distraught in the Bible. Hannah is a good example. Also Elizabeth in the New Testament. It's the Old Testament time still, but in the book of Matthew, in the book of Luke, that you have people who are distraught. The societal expectation was you need to have children. And if you don't, you were an outcast. You were cursed by God. And so what should we think about that perspective? Let's go back to the beginning again. Look at Genesis chapter 1 and verses 27 and 28. Let's start with the command given to Adam and Eve in a perfect world, which, by the way, God never did away with. God never said, by the way, that original command to Adam, you don't have to do that anymore. God mentions this as his will generally, now we're not going to speak in specifics yet, but God's general will for mankind, it's not good that man should be alone. I will give him help that's needed for him. Obviously, it's God's will for some people to remain single. Some people have that gift and calling of God. But as a general rule, God says, I want man, and therefore woman, to marry. It says, by the way, in the New Testament, Paul says, I think it's in Titus, he says, I will that the younger women therefore marry, bear children, guide the house. You know, that's in general, and God has specific things, but I wouldn't say that in general, God just says, do whatever you want, pick whatever you want. In general, God's will is for men to marry women and for them to have families. That's what makes the world go round, so to speak. If we all stop that, then it would take, in about 100 years, there wouldn't be any more people on the earth. If procreation stopped, this is something that should be ongoing. And by the way, if homosexuality, if everyone was homosexual and we did things that way, again, the whole world would die out in 100 years. And I know people try to do all this in vitro stuff and try to shortcut God's design. But God's plan is men and women with children in one man for one woman for one lifetime, having a family and procreating upon the face of the earth. So here's where God initially gives it. Genesis 1, verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So in case you're curious, there's only two genders, male and female. Let's go on. Verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So God, in general, created men and women, told them to get married, told them to be fruitful and multiply. The giving of children in the Bible is often mentioned that it is from God. All throughout the Bible, whenever you see someone not having a child and then all of a sudden they have a child, it always says this, that God opened their wombs or God closed their wombs. It's always God's doing. I know that there's obviously a human element, you know, male plus female equals children. But God says children come from him. It's male plus female plus God. God's will, God's allowing is what gives children. Genesis chapter 30 and verses 1 and 2, it says, and when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. You know, she probably didn't say it like that, right? She was distraught. Give me children or else I die. Or maybe it was like, give me children or else I die. And Jacob went and hid. And then when he came out of hiding, no, verse 2, it says, and Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel. And he said, am I in God's stead who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Jacob recognizes that the giving of children or the not giving of children is in God's hands. He says, I can't just give you children. That's God. Am I in God's place who hath withheld children? It's all in God's hands. In the book of Psalms, it says that children are an heritage of the Lord and the fruit of the womb is his reward. God is the one who gives or doesn't give children. And so that part's in God's hands. So what do we think about barrenness? What about this idea that if you have children, you're blessed by God? If you don't have children, you're not blessed by God. This was something that was part of Israel, of the covenant that God made with Israel. Let's look at a couple of verses about it. Look at Deuteronomy 7 and verse 12. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 12. This became the societal expectation in Israel because of verses, passages like this. So let's Deuteronomy 7, and then we'll turn to Psalm 128. Deuteronomy 7, verse 12 says this, wherefore it shall come to pass, if ye hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord thy God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he sware unto thy fathers. So this passage is to the nation of Israel. Verse 13, and he will love thee and bless thee and multiply thee. He will also bless the fruit of thy womb, and the fruit of thy land, thy corn and thy wine and thine oil, and the increase of thy kine and the flocks of thy sheep and the land which he sware unto thy fathers to give thee. Thou shalt be blessed above all people. There shall not be male or female barren among you, or among your cattle. And the Lord will take away from thee all sickness, and will put none of the evil diseases of Egypt, which thou knowest, upon thee, but will lay them upon all them that hate thee. And thou shalt consume all the people which the Lord thy God shall deliver thee. Thine eyes shall have no pity upon them, neither shalt thou serve their gods, for that will be a snare unto thee. Up and down in this passage, we see that this is a promise, this is a principle that was for the nation of Israel. It's not for just anyone in the world, and even for us in Christianity today. It's not for us to claim, say, hey, if you walk with God, then no one in your family, no one in your church, no one, you know, you're all going to have children. You're all going to be, there's not going to be anyone barren. And including your cattle, and nobody will get sick. I will not lay sickness on thee like I did with the Egyptians. This is not something that we can import to Christianity and say, well, God has transferred this to us now, so we're all going to have children. And none of us are ever going to get sick. And whenever we come into the land, we kill everyone. We don't have pity on anyone. We smite them. This is the nation of Israel for this time as they're going into the land of Canaan. Look at Psalm 128 in verse 1. Psalm 128 in verse 1. And let's read all six verses here, Psalm 128. It says, blessed is everyone that feareth the Lord, that walketh in his ways. For thou shalt eat the labor of thine hands. Happy shalt thou be, and it shall be well with thee. Thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house. Thy children like olive plants round about thy table. Behold, that thus shall the man be blessed that feareth the Lord. The Lord shall bless thee out of Zion, and thou shalt see the good of Jerusalem all the days of thy life. Yea, thou shalt see thy children's children, and peace upon Israel. So this is about Jerusalem and Israel and this covenant that God made with Israel. It's not something that we can take and import into our lives. I will say that in general, with God's order, that he can, that if you have children, that you are blessed by God. It is a blessing, but we can't flip it around automatically and say that if you don't have children, that means you're cursed by God. That is import. That's trying to transfer these promises. You never see something like this in the New Testament, where God says to his people, his bride, the church, that if you walk with me, then all of you will have children and you'll be blessed. You did see all this. I mentioned Elizabeth earlier. Listen to Luke 1:24. It says, and after those days, his wife Elizabeth conceived and hid herself 5 months, saying, thus hath the Lord dealt with me in the days wherein he looked on me to take away my reproach among men. So Elizabeth said, I was reproached among men because I was barren, because she was part of Israel who had these promises. But then God hearkened to her and gave her children, and she was blessed. So that was a time, that was a societal norm in Israel, where if you had children, you were blessed. If you didn't, you were looked on that there was something wrong, that there was spiritually something wrong in God's, there was a reproach and a lack of God's favor. But there's nothing like this in the New Testament for us. And so the way that we should look on it, I think with God's perspective for barrenness, is that we know that childbirth is in God's hands and he gives it or he takes it according. I do believe that we are in general. Now, God brings certain circumstances in time in people's lives. Sometimes there are health issues. Sometimes there are callings to be in a place of danger. Maybe it's not the best time to have children, things like this. But generally and ultimately, children are in God's hands, and we should allow God to make those decisions. Let him decide if we will have children or not have children. Let him decide how many children. Let him decide when we will have children. And often you see in our modern society that, and some of this grew out of maybe World War II. At the end of World War II, things became more expensive, and with men off to war, the women started to work outside the home. It became where it was expensive for one man to just work, and we became a two-income society. Women worked outside. I'm not saying that that's necessarily wrong, but it started to shape family decisions. And we'll push children back because we're not financially ready, or because I want to advance my career, or I want to accomplish these personal things in my life. And in general, our society's gone away from God's plan for family life and so forth. And sometimes it is a lack of faith in the part of a Christian family that decides to not have children. And again, this is not to be specific in anyone's situation, but just in general, it's a good question to ask myself. Am I allowing God to run my life? Is he going to set the course of my dreams and goals and direction, or is it my agenda? Am I basing what I'm doing on societal norms? That if I do this, and there are people, by the way, there are people who don't have children because society will look down on them for having too many children. Well, I don't want them to think I'm weird. I don't want them to think I don't have cable television. I'm just kidding. So they allow the society to shape them. Or they say, I don't think I'll have enough money, instead of saying, I believe that God will provide for whatever he gives. Or they say, I don't think that we'll be able to, I'll have enough energy. I don't think I'll be able to handle it emotionally. And so many times people take the decision out of God's hands for different reasons. And it gets to this point sometimes where we have our own dreams and they don't come to happen. By the way, here's what often happens in our modern society is that women or men and women as a family, they get married and then they wait. Sometimes they wait to get married. Well, I want to establish myself, advance my career, and then one day I'll settle down and get married. And then I'll have children. Or they're married and I want to have children, but just wait 10 years, let me do this. And then after all that waiting, then they find out that they can't, or they've waited too long or something. And then there's heartache and because their dreams didn't come to pass. Proverbs 13:12. Let's turn a couple of verses. Look at Proverbs 13:12 and then Psalm 62:5. Proverbs 13:12 says, "Hope deferred maketh the heart sick, but when the desire cometh, it is a tree of life." In other words, whenever you have an unfulfilled expectation, it often results in discouragement. When you had something that you were hoping for, and then it didn't happen, it got pushed back, that makes your heart sick. And that happens in lots of areas of life, and one of them is in this area of children. Either having children, not being able to have children. Look at Psalm 62 and verse 5. This was our verse for the week in your bulletin. Psalm 62:5. This is a hard place to get to sometimes, but if we get there, it's very liberating and freeing. When we allow God to set our dreams and goals, and when we allow God to set the course of our lives, it says, "My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him." Do you know where many people's expectations are from? They're from TV, they're from movies, they're from the entertainment industry. The life that they have, that's the life that I want to have. And they go for it and then they don't get it. And they are discouraged because their expectation was based on what society wanted. Or they'll enter into a marriage and they were expecting certain things. I was expecting my spouse to treat me like this. I was expecting financially this was going to happen. We're going to have this many children this time. And it didn't happen. And there's discouragement. But if we would say, "God, my expectation is from you. And you give me my dreams. I don't want to have dreams that are apart from God's will. I want God to give me my dreams. Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." And but if we set our own expectations, we will often be discouraged. And so barrenness in a family is sometimes part of this. And I know, by the way, many wonderful, godly, saved parents who or couples that would make great parents, and God has not chosen, at least to this point, to give them children. So what do we think about that? Do we go to these verses in the Old Testament? Hey, there's barren. God says no one's going to be barren. What have you done? You're a wicked sinner. Could you confess right now? What have you done? You know, and God is in charge of these things, and we can never look down our noses and judge other people. But at the same time, and by the way, this is similar to the prosperity gospel type of issue, financial prosperity. If you have a lot of money, does that mean that you are godly and God has blessed you? No, there are many wicked people that are filthy rich. And there are many wicked people that have as many kids as they want. And they just seem to have children. While people that are godly many times are poor. They struggle. They don't have the children that they desire. Does that mean that they're actually not godly, that God is judging them? No, they're both sides. And there's a lot of things going on. And so we need to be very careful about judging other people. We need to see that God has a plan. Whenever you see barrenness in the Bible, you always see God's hand. With Abraham and Sarah, why were Abraham and Sarah barren for so many years? The Bible explains is that because God was giving them a test. God was growing their faith. They failed that test early. They took Hagar and so forth. But God was testing to see if they would believe his promise. I am going to give you a child through Sarah. And his name is going to be Isaac. God was testing their faith to see if they would believe in him. And then eventually God gave them the child. With Hannah and with Elizabeth, God was doing something different. God was, by the way, with both of those barren situations, and then finally they had a child. Those children were specially called by God. John the Baptist and Samuel were great men of God that were set apart to do specific things. And I believe that God used the barrenness to increase their awareness to God's hand in it. When they finally had a child, they said, "This child is from God." And when God said, "I want that child to do something," they were willing to say, "Okay, you can have the child." And we'll talk more about that next week with Hannah and Samuel. For Hannah, it could have also been Elkanah's fault. Did you know that it could have been, I believe, it could have been partially Elkanah's fault that Hannah didn't have children? And I'm not talking about the physical element. I'm talking about the favoritism in the family. It's, by the way, look at Genesis 29 and verse 30. This is about Jacob with Rachel and Leah. I believe the same exact thing could have gone on with Elkanah. So Genesis 29 and verse 30. So he's married now to both. Jacob's married to Rachel and Leah. Verse 30 says, "And he went in also unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 other years. And when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." I believe that the reason Rachel didn't have children for a while, this was because Jacob favored her. It gave her all the love. And says because of that, God opened the womb of Leah, and I believe he closed it so that Jacob wouldn't just get what he wanted. I only want Rachel. And God rewards him with lots of children with Rachel. God closed her womb, I believe, because of his favoritism, because of the way he mistreated Leah. And I believe maybe the same thing could have happened with Elkanah. That because Elkanah loved Hannah only, that God opened Peninnah's womb and kept Hannah's closed. So maybe it was partially Elkanah's fault with the polygamy and the mistreatment and the favoritism. But I believe this, the bottom line with Hannah's barrenness, I believe that the reason she was barren was so that the events would play out exactly the way that they did. How'd they play out, by the way? She was barren. And by the way, this is, we didn't talk about this morning. Maybe we'll look at it a little bit next week. But I love what Hannah does. There is no conversation in Samuel between Hannah and Peninnah. She provokes her. She provokes her day by day by day. And Hannah never responds in the Bible to Peninnah. Who does she talk to? She talks to God. She takes her problem to God. When she has an enemy, she goes to God and says, "God, you bless according to your will." And so I believe that the reason Hannah was barren was so that the events would play out this way, so that Hannah would desperately go to God and God could give her a child. And she would be so grateful that she would say, "God, I give this child to." I believe that God, it was God's will for her to make that vow that we read about. "God, if you will bless me with a man child, I will give him to you all the days of his life." And God separated Samuel out so that he could be a special prophet and judge and do great things. And I believe that if Hannah just had children immediately when she wanted, that may not have happened. She doesn't send him off to the temple to grow and learn and worship God the same way. And so I believe that the barrenness was God's hand on purpose for that. By the way, it's interesting. I'm not going to say that. Okay. You guys are trying to bait me into say something I regret. I want to finish with a couple of thoughts. It wasn't a sinful thing, but I probably just shouldn't have said it. A question that we all should grapple with is, am I going to allow God, and we're not just talking here about family planning and so forth, but am I going to allow God to chart the course of my life? When children grow up, what's a question we often ask them? What do you want to be? What do you want to do when you grow up? And that's the wrong starting point. It's not what do you want. It's just what God wants. That's what we all need to, as we're growing up and as we're old, where do I want to work now? Who do I want to marry? This is the way that so many Christians live their lives. And we need to just say, my soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectations from him. And if you do that, God will guide and direct you. He will give you Psalm 184 and verse 11. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly, from them that leave the choosing to him. And God will bless, but are we willing to trust God enough to let him chart the course of our lives? Or do we need to follow our own goals and our own dreams? Well, this, you don't understand. This is something that I've wanted since I was 5 years old. Who cares? Who cares what I want, what we want? What matters is what does God want? And Hannah was desperate, but she gives it to God, and then God blesses. Are we going to live our lives according to societal norms? Are we going to let the society tell us what is right and what is normal and what we should chase after? Are we going to feel ostracized just because society thinks we're ostracized? Are we going to give our lives to God? And are we going to be gentle like Peninnah was not? Are we going to be gentle and understanding and loving when we're surrounded with people who are struggling with these areas, who have unfulfilled expectations? Are we going to be a thorn in their side and add fuel to the fire of their misery? Or are we going to come along and be an encouragement? By the way, sometimes the reason someone has a problem is so that you can come and help them with their problems. Bear ye one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Sometimes the reason God gives someone a burden that's more than they can handle is so that you and I can come and help them with that burden. We need to be sensitive to that. But are we going to live our lives selfishly? And only I only care about my dreams and my goals and my agenda, and who cares about anyone else? Or are we going to be loving the way that God would have us to be? Next week, we'll continue with Hannah's story and the beautiful gift that she gives of Samuel. Let's pray together this morning.